digging in the dirt. Digging in the dirt.
This is Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher, where Kevin and his guests dig a little deeper into today's issues surrounding the environment, farming, gardening, and food.
Two very useful books called Put 'em Up Preserving Answer Book, Put 'em Up Fruit, and one called Eat It Up Recipes. Welcome, Sherry.
Thank you so much for having me, Kevin.
So you've written a lot of details in all these books about all kinds of food and how to put them up and how to save them for a later time. After all your research and testing, what's your favorite way to preserve food?
It depends on my time constraints, you know, what I have in front of me and how long I have to play with it. Of course, you know, the boiling water method, the master method of preserving food is going to give you the longest shelf life. So if I have the time for that, that's certainly something I love to endeavor to do. But if I'm in a rush, I can just plunk fruits and vegetables down in a brine or a vinegar solution and pop them in the fridge, and that will buy me some shelf life there. So it really depends on what you're in the mood for.
So when you say the hot water method, we're talking now like ball jar canning?
That's right. Boiling water method is when you preserve your food in boiling water. You don't need a lot of special equipment. You do need the specialized canning jars, though. They have the three-part system, the jar, the lid, and the ring, that are going to give you that airtight seal.
So let's talk to the people out there that haven't done this before. Let's talk about the do's and don'ts of canning in this manner. Some people have scary things in their mind because they hear, oh, botulism, where, you know, if you don't do it right and you're going to get somebody sick. Is this really a real reality?
Well, you're right. I think that is the first thing that pops into people's minds. It's the first question that I certainly get when I'm teaching people how to preserve is, will I kill my family? But, you know, although, you know, anytime you are working with food, anytime that you're cooking, you have certain rules that you have to follow to prevent foodborne illness from entering the equation. And the same is true with preserving. Although it's really not nearly as frightening as people make it out to be.
So what are the do's and don'ts and the basic rules of this?
Sure. Well, I would say that primarily if you just follow the bouncing ball, if you get a modern preserving book and follow the recipe in there, then you're going to be just fine. People get into most trouble when they kind of play fast and loose with their recipes and improvise. And you can't do that because there's a science behind canning, and you have to achieve a very specific pH level to keep things safe on the shelf. But you don't have to measure the pH. You don't have to know the science behind the process. If you just follow the proportions in your recipe, then you'll be safe.
That's very interesting. So just grab yourself a good recipe. So give us I'm a big tomato guy. Give me a good recipe for tomatoes other than just, you know, cooking them down and putting them in the jar.
Oh, yeah. Well, everybody does, you know, the whole tomatoes in the jar. And that's great. You know, but it can be a little bit of a process to can whole tomatoes. And if you're just starting out, that might not be the way you want to go. I just came across, I planted a garden here in LA for my first time this season, along with many other eaters out there jumping into the backyard farm this season. Yep. And my tomatoes started coming in fast and furious, you know, much quicker than I could eat them, but not fast enough that I would have enough to merit the time commitment of boiling water method processing. So I just took all of the tomatoes that I had and I put them in a roaster with a little bit of olive oil and a couple cloves of garlic, popped them in the oven while I was making dinner, and then let them cook down until they were bursting and all the juices had been released and that wonderful tomato flavor was really concentrated. And then I just scooped them all into a freezer bag and popped them in the freezer, and I was done. And that's tomato sauce for another day.
You're right. You're right. That's something we do here too. We two things we do with our cherries and these little currant style tomatoes is put them into a, you know, a nice like we said dish or something and cook them down with oil and olives and fresh herbs and then put them in a jar for smearing on things later. That's one of our favorite things.
That's delicious. It's a great thing to do. But you know, salsas also. If you have a few tomatoes and maybe some chilies or peppers around, salsa is a great way to go. And you could preserve that salsa using the boiling water method, and you wouldn't need a huge accumulation of fruit to do it.
This reminds me because we dehydrate cherries too, cherry tomatoes. We, you know, we have a dehydrator. Is it, I think, pretty good, you know, because you can reconstitute them later in the season. Are there any other things or that can be dehydrated? I mean, I don't think big sliced tomatoes work so well, but little things seem to work. Is there other things that work well in dehydration?
Sure. You know, a lot of people use a dehydrator, and I have a friend who just makes masses of dehydrated chilies, and then she grinds them up and has homemade chili powder. And I think that's brilliant, because not only are you preserving your chilies, but you're being really economical with your shelf space when you grind them up like that. But if you don't have a dehydrator, you can still dry food. You just have to make sure that you have good air circulation. You want to, maybe if you had a nice dry attic with a window that you could crack open, or you could put a little fan up there, that would be great. And you could dry a lot of things like chilies that have a thin skin. You wouldn't want a really thick skinned chili, but little Thai chilies are great for drying. And, you know, I have a recipe in my book for drying green beans. And this is like an old-fashioned recipe that people used to use called leather breeches. And you just string them on a cord and dry them out in the sun. Bring them in during the night so they don't get damp. You know, those East Coast summers have that humidity that can really settle on them at night. But if you dry the beans like that, green beans, and then you can store them in an airtight container, then that's a great project for kids as well. You just have to make sure you pop them in the oven for a little bit before you put them in your container to make sure that you have banished any little visitors that have come to your green beans.
Sounds good. But you know, that means it's a fully like mature bean. I mean, there's beans in there. Don't they dry out and become hard?
Well, it's a good recipe for reconstituting the beans in soups and stews in the winter. So yeah, they would become kind of hard, but when you put them back in your recipe, they spring back to life.
Huh. Very good. Yeah. I'm going to have to try the chilies thing. I haven't done that yet. And mostly my cherry tomatoes and things like that. And herbs.
There's a lot you can do with drying. My favorite is drying citrus rinds. This is a great thing to do in the winter time. You know, oftentimes people think of preserving as just a summer activity, but really September is the best month to preserve because you're on that bridge between summer and fall, and there's just so much available. But you can even preserve into the winter time when citrus is running really strong. I love to take the peels of citrus, lemons, oranges particularly, even grapefruit. And oftentimes that's something that you would discard, but if you cut them into strips and give them several boils in a sugar water and like a simple syrup, and then just lay them on a rack, they dry and they become candied. You can just eat them like a treat, maybe dip cans in chocolate. It makes a great holiday gift.
Sounds good. So how about freezing? Now, is there any rules about freezing? Because sometimes you get all that, you know, those ice crystals inside the bags and stuff like that. And, you know, and should you blanch before you freeze, or can you, are there certain things you could just throw in regardless?
That's a great question. I just did a class on preserving in the freezer. People really can use that as a little time machine in their kitchen when they need to preserve food. And it doesn't take a lot of investment in equipment, but you do need to remove the moisture from your produce. And you can do that in a number of different ways. Blanching is certainly something that will you know, it sounds counterintuitive that you're going to put something like green beans down into some boiling water and it's going to remove moisture, but it does. It takes some of the moisture out of them. It sets the color. It deactivates the enzymes that would break down your produce in the freezer. Because freezing slows decay, but it doesn't completely stop it. So the blanching will cease that process. So for things like green beans and corn, you want to give them a little bit of a blanch before you dry them and put them in airtight containers in the freezer. But if you don't want to blanch, you can saute as well. I do things like leeks, for example, if you want to preserve leeks in the freezer. Just chop them up, saute them in olive oil and maybe a little bit of butter. And then you can even divide them in an ice cube tray and freeze them and then transfer that to an airtight bag. And you'll have little single-use portions of sauteed leeks to use in your recipes.
That's a cool idea. I like that. But you know, I've had some problems with freezing, you know, I've frozen like peppers and then when I defrost them, they're kind of mushy, you know, and I'm not really pleased with them. What did I do wrong?
Well, you're never going to have that same crunch of fresh produce when you bring it out of the freezer. There's always going to be a little bit of a shift in texture, sometimes color. So for peppers, I would definitely either blanch them or saute them to seize any sort of decay or as much as you can seize that degradation of texture. But you have to kind of shift your expectation. Things that come out of the freezer are going to be great, but they're not going to be the same.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And you probably could make a puree out of them and freeze them in like the ice trays, as you said.
You know, for peppers, what I love to do with them is to roast them right directly over an open flame. I roast my peppers. Red peppers are particularly delicious done this way. You could do chilies too. And then you roast them. You put them in a bowl and cover it for 15 minutes so they steam. And then take the cover off, let them cool to room temperature, at least until a temperature that you can handle them. And then you peel off those darkened skins and remove the ribs and seeds. And you have roasted peppers. And those are delicious. And they stand up very well in the freezer. And you can freeze them in strips or chop them or puree them. And that's a great ingredient to have on hand.
Yes, it's always good to have something that's easy around. We're talking to Sherry Brooks Vinton. She's written several books on put 'em up. That's the theme, put 'em up, put 'em up preserving answer book, things like that. So we're talking about all these different ways to save your food when you have maybe too much of it, or you went out and bought a gross of something. You know, one thing I get a lot of, and I think a lot of people do, is zucchini. So help us out with zucchinis. They seem to be like either prolific or submarines when you get to them, you don't find one what do you do with a zucchini?
I don't know what happens to zucchinis overnight in the garden. There must be some sort of, oh, I don't know, some zucchini fairy that comes and stretches them, because they certainly do explode. But I like to make zucchini pickles. And you can do that just as you would a cucumber pickle or even a refrigerator pickle, which is a wonderful trick to have up your sleeve when you have too much coming too quickly from the garden. And that's just simply cutting your zucchini into spears, putting them into a canning jar. It has to be canning jar because you're going to put some hot liquid in there and you want it to have that thick glass that won't crack. But then you just make a nice, easy brine, 1-to-1 vinegar and water, a little bit of salt and sugar, and pour that hot liquid over top and let it cool to room temperature and then cover and refrigerate. And, you know, you can have those maybe in a day or so. They're going to be full of flavor and they'll last for up to 3 weeks in the fridge.
Hmm. I guess the same thing with cucumbers.
Yes, I love to make an Asian cucumber refrigerator pickle, and that's the same theory, but I slice the cucumbers in coins and then put those in the jar, maybe with some sliced onions, and instead of like a regular white vinegar or red wine vinegar, I use rice vinegar and a little bit of soy sauce, maybe some sesame oil, seasoned with the sugar and salt, And I pour that over the cucumbers and put that in the refrigerator. And that's a delightful treat.
Yeah. Wow. I'll have to look for that. Do you like hot stuff? I mean, do you like to make some of these things spicy?
I do. You know, I love pickled jalapenos because not only do you get the wonderful pickled vegetable, but the juice that is in that pickle jar is a wonderful condiment in its own right. So I pickle jalapenos, refrigerator pickle them, and I boiling water I preserve them using the boiling water method. But I avoid this one mistake, and I hope you will too. And that is, you always want to add the hot brine to the chilies, not the chilies to the hot brine. And that's because if you boil chilies in your kitchen, your nose will know it. You will sneeze, your eyes will run. If you have any pets in the house, they will sneeze too. It sets off a firebomb. You really have to be careful with that one.
So say that again, you put the brine into the chilies?
That's right. Okay. You want to pack your jars with chilies and then pour hot brine over them. Don't simmer your chilies in hot brine on the stove because mm-hmm. the steam has all of that capsaicin in it, and it will be like a little tear gas in your kitchen.
So now let's move on to another area. How about fermenting our fruits and vegetables? What can you tell us about fermenting?
Fermenting is a wonderful kitchen science, and I think it's fantastic because it has wonderful flavor. It's really interesting to watch the process happen. But most of all, when you are eating fermented vegetables, you're enjoying probiotics, which are the beneficial bacteria that you get from yogurt, sometimes people take them as a supplement, probiotics. It's just a really good for your gut health probiotics. So I love to ferment pickles, you know, classic crock pickles, and you're just going to put those down into a nice clean crock with some brine, 3 tablespoons of salt to every quart of water, and pour that over your trimmed cucumbers, maybe with some seasonings if that's what you like. And if you put a little plate on them, keep them submerged, magic will happen. The salt will abate any sort of contaminating bacteria, and the lactic bacteria on the vegetables will create lactic acid, which gives you that tart flavor, and then the beneficial bacteria will take over and cure your food. And it's just fantastic to watch. It bubbles, you know, like a mad science experiment. And in the course of a week or so, you've turned a cucumber into a pickle with just a little bit of salt and water.
Certainly, I've been seeing a lot of stories about this. It seems like it's very popular because people are worried about gut health these days, and it seems that this helps out in that regard.
Yeah, it's the same principle with sauerkraut as well. You're just fermenting cabbage, and you get all that beneficial bacteria, the lactobacilli in your gut, and it's fantastic. And it's also great for digestion. That's why when you get one of those big, heavy deli sandwiches that are, you know, packed with pastrami or something like that, there's always a pickle on the side. And that's because that food tradition recognizes that all that heavy, fatty food gets digested more easily when it has a little fermented bite on the side. That fermented pickle helps you digest that delicious but somewhat heavy meal.
You know, I never put that together before. That's interesting. That's cool. So, the difference between pickling and fermenting is a crock, or, I mean,
those words get kind of thrown around synonymously, but fermenting is one thing. And then making quick pickles is another thing. Vinegar pickles are another thing. So they get used interchangeably, but really when you say you're making a vinegar pickle, that's when you're using the boiling water method and pickling is usually fermenting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love kimchi. Is it easy to make kimchi? And it's done in layers, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, kimchi is like its own art form and a wonderful Korean tradition. And every house has their own recipe for kimchi, but the key ingredients are nice cabbage, sometimes bok choy, sometimes a little carrot. I've seen almost every vegetable in it, and it often has fish sauce that gives it that really pungent flavor and aroma.
Hmm. Have you ever attempted to make it?
I have. It has its fan base. I admire it. I like to eat it. I don't like to make it as much because I don't have the square footage in my house.
I hear you.
It has a really funky, pungent smell, and some people love it. And I did not grow up with it, so that is not my favorite thing to make. If I had a separate garage or something where I could make that separate from my house, maybe I would do that. But it really takes on a life of its own.
Yeah, it's understandable. That's understandable.
Yeah, crock pickles will do that too. Regular kosher dills that you're fermenting up, they have a really distinct aroma as well. But I grew up with a Polish grandmother, so I grew up with that, and it just smells like home to me. And I'm sure that's the same for kimchi.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, it's a staple on any Korean restaurant, or I go to the Asian supermarket near me, and boy, do they have variety. I mean, I don't know what to buy there. It's so crazy how many different kimchis there are.
Yeah, it's wonderful though, right? And people really get into it.
Yeah, they really do. I like it when I like it with another food. You know, I don't just can't eat kimchi. Let me ask you, you know, with the time remaining that we have, I've seen some of the stuff you've written about real food, knowing your food, and how to reclaim the food chain. You want to tell me a little bit about, tell our audience what's concerning you there?
Oh boy, that's a big one.
I know it is, but we can
for a whole other at least half hour. But I could just say, you know, where to start, I guess where I started, which was I had all these preconceived notions about our food system and how our food was grown. And that was informed largely by how I grew up. My mother's side of the family were farmers in South Carolina. So I grew up seeing that kind of farm. And I guess I just thought that that's what farming was like, just on a bigger scale. And then 20 years ago, I can't believe it's 20 years ago, but 20 years ago, my husband and I were going across country on a motorcycle, and I was so excited to see all the farms. And when we got out to the Midwest, it was just a really different scene. It was full of industrial agriculture. These are, you know, just monoculture farms of corn and soy, basically, in the Midwest. They don't feed people. They just create the building blocks for fast food. And it was really disorienting to me because it wasn't what I expected. I really didn't even understand what I was seeing at the time. But when I came back to the East Coast, I started digging around, found some great organizations that were supporting local food. And I started to tap into what you might call an alternative food system. It was much more under the radar then than it is now, but people were joining CSAs, community-sponsored agriculture programs, and really supporting local seasonal food. And, you know, I had always enjoyed a trip through a farmer's market as much as anybody else on a Saturday. You know, it's a lovely place to be. But I really started to understand the importance of supporting our local farmers and decentralizing our food chain so that all of our food isn't produced in California, or the majority of it is produced in California. And like I said, the Midwest doesn't produce really food so much as these byproducts of fast food, or building blocks of fast food, I should say. So I started to support local agriculture, and it's just beneficial in so many different ways. you're making a more robust food system because you are not transporting your food all over. You're reducing your dependence on fossil fuels because you're not relying on that transport. You're creating a more stable system because your food isn't centralized. Food's allowed to grow to ripeness. You know, a lot of our food is shipped unripe so that it can withstand the journey. And food that's grown on this industrial scale has to be propped up with a lot of chemical applications, and local food is more robust because it is grown on polycultures, on fields that have lots of different crops and rotating crops, which is much more healthy for the produce and for the soil, which regenerates in that way. And it's healthier for you because it's not loaded with all these chemicals. So you can get a better quality food. You can get more variety. Farmers can grow varieties that don't transport well, like heirloom varieties that have more flavor, that are actually grown for their flavor rather than their ability to survive transport. And it's just delicious. You know, when I lived on the East Coast, I lived in Easton. Sport Hill Farm was right up the road from us, and they fed my family. Patty Pop there was growing beautiful, beautiful produce. And that's where we got all of our meals all year round, you know, that during the summer, everything that was coming off fresh. And then during the winter, everything that was in cold storage. And that is the most delicious food you're going to enjoy.
Yeah. Dina has a great farm. She's been a guest here, and she actually recommended I talk to you, which was, that's great. It worked out great. So I guess that's what you mean about knowing your food. It's really knowing your farmer, right?
That's right. When you know your farmer, like Patty Pop or like Dina Brewster, you know, you create that relationship, and it's a relationship with your grower, which makes for a more stable food system. When they have a community supporting them and they're supporting you, that's a wonderful exchange that creates a stability, you know, a stability in the food chain. But also, it's just lovely. It's lovely to visit these farms. It's lovely to know where your food is coming from, to be able to show your kids, you know, this is the salad we're having, and that's where it grew. And, you know, point to the field, take them out to the field, close that knowledge gap.
Right. Salad doesn't come in a plastic container, washed four times.
Exactly. Soaked in bleach.
Yeah. So the last thing we'll talk about here is, so we have that, how to reclaim the food chain. Okay, so give it to us. How do we reclaim the food chain?
How do you reclaim the food chain? You shorten that chain as much as you can. So that is connecting with local growers, either in your community or at a local farmer's market, joining a CSA, a community-sponsored agriculture program, looking for local food in your supermarket, and if they don't have it, asking them why they don't, and maybe growing something of your own, whether it's, you know, your whole backyard is converted into a backyard farm, or it's just a couple pots of herbs on your windowsill. Growing your own food is a great form of connection.
I agree with you totally. We've been talking to Sherry Brooks Vinton. She has several books, and you can look them up as Put 'em Up. And you can also find a lot of information on her very informative website if you're interested in more on the subject at sherrybrooksvinton.com. Sherry, I really appreciate you coming on. Thanks so much for sharing your wisdom.
This was a great joy, Kevin. Thank you so much for having me.
Take care.
Digging in the dirt. Digging in the dirt.
You've been listening to Digging in the Dirt with Kevin Gallagher.